WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Free speech radio news airs every Friday at 5 on WEFT Community Radio, followed by Smile Politely Radio, coming up next.
Scared as a setting sun, scared of the coming night, scared as a setting sun, praying for daylight. Set free, his arms are all I know.
You're listening to Smile Politely Radio. SmilePolitely.com is the place to go for all things local. Arts, music, food and drink, culture, opinion, tech, and much more. I am the host of the show, Rebecca, and to get us started today, we heard a track from Kaname called Setting Sun. Kaname is playing on Saturday at 9 at the Loose Cobra, so you can add that to your Halloween activities. I'm joined in the studio today by James Kilgore. Hi, James.
How are you doing, Rebecca?
Good. How are you? Good. James is an educator at the University of Illinois, an activist involved in local social justice campaigns and has been for a number of years. And he's also the author of several books, including most recently, Understanding Mass Incarceration, A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Issue of Our Time. So I'm excited to hear about your book and about what its key arguments are about this very important issue.
Okay, so maybe I can just talk a little bit about how I came to write this book. I spent 6.5 years in prison in California in federal and state institutions. And during that time, I really saw like an endless stream of disproportionately black and brown bodies, but lots of poor white bodies coming through the gates. And this was like 2002 to 2009. I wasn't that clear on exactly what was happening. I didn't even know this term, mass incarceration. But I could see that there was something really out of whack here, especially when I talked to people and found out that the stories of what they had done or what they were convicted for didn't really make sense when I found out how much time they were doing. And I found people doing enormous amounts of time for drug offenses and other offenses that didn't seem to warrant that time. We had people doing life, double life. I had a friend that was doing 555 years for money laundering as part of drug dealing. So when I came out of prison in 2009, one of the things I was determined to do was to find out what was behind all this, because I felt some kind of obligation to the people that I had left behind. And I wanted to see if I could do something to kind of stem this flow of bodies into the prison system, into becoming part of mass incarceration, which I then found out about after reading, and I became involved to some extent in local struggles around these issues. But as I did that, I was researching and writing. I have a history of doing popular education work or writing textbooks and materials for social movements, popular kinds of things that are accessible rather than academic. So that's why I thought that there needed to be some kind of a primer about mass incarceration that would be accessible. My idea really was that what I would write would be accessible to the people that I left behind in prison, whose level of education isn't that high, but whose level of motivation to read something like this would be very high. So that's kind of what I set out to do. So I've given an overview, which I hope is pretty complete, going from, you know, Reagan to Obama, going from the school to prison pipeline to the changing situation, people who are on parole and probation post-release, looking at race and gender as they are part of mass incarceration. I've tried to give a pretty big overview of what the system looks like and try to make a motivation for why I've called this the key civil rights struggle of our time.
Could you say a little bit more about that specifically? What argument are you making in the book that links this to the key civil rights struggle of our time?
Well, I think if we look at the scale of mass incarceration changing from less than 500,000 people in prison before 1980 to 2.2 or 3 million people in jails and prisons at the moment, we've seen that this has been a major transformation of American society. And this is not simply about locking people up and putting them behind bars. It's much more about how do we deal with problems of poverty, inequality, homelessness, mental health, substance abuse. We've chosen to deal with all of those problems by punishing the people who have those problems rather than providing support for them. And so we now find that our institutions are filled with people who have mental health issues, with people who have substance abuse issues, or people who are just plain poor and can't afford to pay a traffic fine or an ordinance violation fine, and that puts them into a whole cycle of incarceration which can go on for years. So I'm trying to make the argument that mass incarceration has been a total disaster as a social policy, and that it's much broader than just building prisons and jails, although that's a very key aspect of it. But in order to reverse it, we need to think not only about criminal justice, but much more broadly about poverty, inequality, and particularly about race and class.
Mm-hmm. So I know you were mentioning before the show that one of the chapters in your book addresses jails and the issue of incarceration at the local level. And obviously here in Champaign-Urbana, there's been a very ongoing conversation about what our local system of incarceration should look like or not look like. Could you speak a little bit to that particular issue, what incarceration, how the situation of incarceration in Champaign-Urbana maps onto this national conversation, and maybe speak a little bit about what's happening currently locally to combat this important issue?
Okay, well, thanks for asking that. I think it's really important that we can localize mass incarceration, because when most people think of mass incarceration, they tend to think of these big, huge, imposing facilities like Stateville or something, these old prisons or the newer high-tech versions of these massive institutions that hold thousands of people. But if we look at jails, we find that across the country, on any given day, jails hold somewhere around 600,000 or 700,000 people. But if we look at that on a yearly cycle, because people tend to stay in county jails for short periods of time, we find that there's somewhere around 11 million admissions to jail in a year. So it's a huge scale in terms of the people that it impacts. And almost every county and many cities have a jail, which is one of the major kind of capital expenses in any municipality. So I'm trying to argue that we need to think about these jails as a key component, because they're also the first stop for people who end up in state prisons for the most part. But as a local government issue, they're also very important. And I think that surfaced in Champaign County when in 2012, the local law enforcement and the judiciary and some members of the county board came forward with a proposal to build a $20 million extension or new structure onto the existing county jail in East Urbana, what's called the satellite jail. We also have a downtown jail, which was built in 1980. The satellite jail was built in the late 1990s, and it's a newer facility. So their plan really was to close the downtown facility, which was less than half full, and build more capacity at the East Urbana site. And in particular, they were talking about building a mental health facility within the jail because there were so many people with mental health issues in the jail. Now, a number of us in the community, most of us were part of Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice, we formed an organization called No More Jails. And our position was that the county should not be spending more money on jails, that the county should be looking at ways to finance programs and alternatives to incarceration, that rather than building a mental health facility inside the jail, the county should be building a mental health facility outside the jail, because part of the reason why we have so many people with mental health issues in the jail is simply because the police, if someone is acting out or having a mental health crisis in a public space, the police have nowhere to take these people because the mental health facilities have been closed down. The substance abuse, the detox centers have been closed down. So there's nowhere to take people, so they all end up in the jail. So the solution to that, from our perspective, was not to build more jail cells or build more functional jail cells, but rather to find ways to keep people out of jail. So in the last 3 years, we've been pushing around the issue of funding alternatives to incarceration. And we've changed our name from No More Jails to Build Programs, Not Jails. And the most recent focus of our campaign has really been to look at the racial disparity in the jail. And I must point out that we have succeeded so far in stopping them from building a jail. They have not built, a single new cell, and there's no money allocated for that project at the moment. I think we've changed the conversation about that issue in the county. But more recently, we've also focused on the racial disparity in the jail population. In September of this year, the jail population in Champaign County was 71% African Americans in a county that's 13% black. Now there's something woefully out of balance there. And this is a common thread through criminal justice around the country. I mean, Michelle Alexander has written a book called The New Jim Crow, which talks about in particular the way in which the war on drugs has ended up incarcerating a lot of African American people. And African Americans make up almost 40% of people in prisons nationwide, even though, once again, they're about 14% of the general population. So that local racial disparity has been the focus of a very intense struggle in the last month to get our county to establish a racial justice task force to look at why we have so many black people in this jail and recommend some ways to change that reality that the county board could undertake.
When you were describing your book, you were tracing this historical trajectory of mass incarceration over the last several decades. And I'm wondering at this point, either nationally or locally, if you are noticing any positive changes in terms of mass incarceration.
Well, one of the things that's happened, particularly in the last year, but really in the last 3 or 4 years, is all of a sudden people have discovered mass incarceration. It's become a popular issue. If we go back to 2012, in the presidential election, criminal justice, mass incarceration, they weren't mentioned at all. They just didn't even feature, even though the prison population was just about at its peak in 2012. So the fact that this has come out in the last year, I think, is the result of two things. One is that we've seen fiscal conservatives, people like Rand Paul and Gingrich, surprisingly, come out and start to talk about mass incarceration, the need to reduce correction spending, and the need to reduce the number of people in prisons and jails. This is shocking. I mean, these are some of the people who are the main architects of mass incarceration, who are pushing tough on crime, lock them up and throw away the key, build more prisons, build more jails, fund policing, et cetera, et cetera. And now all of a sudden, you know, they've shifted. And I think they've shifted largely for financial reasons. And that is that since the financial crisis of 2008, it's warranted a much closer look at state and local budgets. And people have just seen that the, you know, the spending on corrections, I mean, it's ballooned from $7 billion in 1980 to more than $80 billion annually. At this time, that's an enormous increase, and it's unsustainable. So I think the fiscal conservatives, although they may talk about loss of human potential and so forth, I think their main focus really is budgetary. But I think more important than that has been in the last year, from I'd say from the moment of the shooting of Trayvon Martin, the murder of Trayvon Martin. From that point on, we've seen a massive change in popular consciousness about the issue of policing, particularly in relation to African Americans. And we've seen the rising up of black people and communities across this country in organizations like Black Lives Matter, in the Ferguson Action Committee and so forth, that have taken up these issues. And I think they have put this onto the agenda of politicians who are afraid that if they don't have any kind of response, they're going to have a rebellion on a scale that they can't control. And I think that's also been even further highlighted by a similar kind of mobilization, which was drew less publicity, but was on a similar scale, and that is that which was undertaken largely by Latino youth to focus on the escalating numbers of deportations, and President Obama deporting more people than George Bush or any president previously. And so these two social movements of predominantly Latinos and African Americans, I think, have really shaken up political leaders and caused them to think we better do something about this issue, or we're going to have something that's a lot bigger and a lot more difficult to control than we ever dreamed of.
You mentioned in your response to the question about incarceration at the local level, the recent passage by the county board to have a racial justice task force here in Champaign County. Could you speak a little bit about what you hope that task force will accomplish?
Well, the racial justice task force grew out of a community justice task force that I was a part of, along with State Representative Carol Ammons. And in 2013, we put forward a number of recommendations. Our task was to look at alternatives to incarceration. And we put forward a number of recommendations about mental health, substance abuse treatment. But one of the recommendations we put forward was to form a racial justice task force to deal with that disparity. Since that time, a number of us have repeatedly gone back to the county board meetings and tried to motivate for this to be implemented. We've also had one-on-ones with a lot of county board members trying to get them to take up, and we've had very little luck with this. But we came back with it again in the late summer of this year, in the wake of all the things I spoke about in relation to policing and abuse of African Americans. And we felt that it was a moment where the county board was really going to have to hear this. So we went last month, and we had a huge delegation. I think over 100 people were there. We had a very strong presence from the newly formed chapter of Black Lives Matter in Champaign-Urbana. And a lot of speakers came forward and motivated as to why this racial justice task force needed to happen, and that it needed to address these issues of racial disparity in the jail. So what we're hoping that this will accomplish is, first of all, for the first time, we want the county authorities to admit that they have a problem, that this is a real issue. It's not something we're making up. It's something that's very real and needs the attention of the elected officials. I mean, our position is that the county has jurisdiction over the jail. There, it's the taxpayers' money paid to the county that funds the operation of the jail, and they're complicit in operating a jail that is highly racialized. So we want to focus on that, and we want to investigate what are the reasons why we have this racial disparity. I think we know some of the answers, but across the country, what's happened is that people who are looking at racial justice in the criminal justice system, they're looking at the various stages of the criminal justice system and seeing ways in which there might be racial discrimination and policies that might be able to limit that, to eliminate it, or to at least monitor it and have some kind of system of checks and balances when things get out of balance. So this begins with traffic stops. It may begin with pedestrian stops. It may begin with vehicles being pulled over. We've seen the Urbana City is just about to complete a task force looking at the racial discrimination, the driving while black syndrome, which has clearly been in evidence for a number of years. And that's to the credit of the Urbana City Council that they've taken this up and tried to address that. But once someone's pulled over and arrested, there's a whole other set of points where discrimination takes place and where it's been found in other jurisdictions. A, the decision about whether to arrest somebody or simply give them a written citation. Then once you charge somebody, what do they charge with? Then once they're in jail, what kind of bail conditions do they have? How much do they have to pay for bail? What kind of plea bargains do they get if their case is solved by a plea bargain within a trial, and more than 90% of cases are solved through plea bargains with the state's attorney? And then what kind of sentences do people get? And what we've seen across the country when studies have been done comparing, for example, white defendants who have a drug case and black defendants who have a drug case with similar backgrounds and similar amounts of drugs and similar drugs involved, there's a disparity in terms of how they get sentenced. So what we're hoping that this task force can do is to be able to look at these criminal justice manifestations of inequality and come up with ways to monitor them and maybe come up with policies that can reduce any disparities that are discovered. Now, we don't want to say that all of the disparity in the county jail population is due to the criminal justice system. There's a lot of issues that have to do with poverty and inequality in the broader society that also have an impact on this. Most of these, for example, say education, are not things that the county board really has direct responsibility for. But what we're saying to the county, you are responsible for criminal justice. You run the jail, you fund the sheriff, you fund the state's attorney, you fund the judges and the courts. That is your ambit. It's time you address the racial disparity in there and make some changes that change that enormous disparity of 58% between the blacks in the general population and 71% and the blacks in the jail population of 71%.
Thinking outward to the national stage, what do you hope will change about mass incarceration in the coming years, the coming decade, and looking out?
Well, I think we're at a moment where we could see big change. I think we're also at a moment where we could see a lot of talk and very little substantive change. I think there's three things that we need to monitor in terms of seeing how far we're progressing. The first is we need to reduce the number of people in prisons and jails. And that sounds very simplistic, but for example, if we look at the bill that Bernie Sanders offered up around criminal justice, I mean, one of the things he calls for is for the elimination of contracts with private prisons. Well, that's fine, but it doesn't really automatically reduce the number of people who are in prison, because if we cut off private prison contracts, where do the people that are in those prisons go? Likely they go back to state institutions. That doesn't fundamentally change the scale of mass incarceration. We have to reduce that number. In order to get back to the levels of incarceration of 1980, where all this began, we're talking about reducing our prison population by something like 80%. That's somewhere around 1.7 million people being out of prisons and jails into the community. So that requires a huge shift. And I think that brings me to my second point, which is that it requires a shift in mindset. All right. We cannot continue to have the lock them up and throw away the key philosophy. We have to think about the state as a state that can provide support and social welfare programs for people, that can generate employment, that can improve the educational performance, that can provide more public housing. The major public housing programs in the U.S. for the last three decades have been prisons and jails. That's where public housing money has been redirected. So all of these, we need to rethink how the state addresses issues of poverty and inequality and racial conflict. And without that, we're just tweaking the system. We'll change a few laws. We'll let out a few people who have nonviolent convictions, but we're not going to fundamentally attack the problem. And the third thing, which also relates to that, is we need to be reinvesting money. That is, mass incarceration may be mass, but it's not spread evenly like butter-us toast. It's targeted specific communities, and predominantly inner city communities of people of color are the communities that have been decimated by mass incarceration. They've been further hit by cutbacks in public benefits, in education, and public housing, so that the standard of living of these communities has been grossly impacted by mass incarceration. A disproportionate number of the people left behind in those communities are women who have been shouldering extra burdens of finance, extra burdens of parenting, extra burdens of holding the community together, and also extra burdens of protecting their existing children from the over-policing of those communities and keeping them from being entrapped in the system of mass incarceration. So we need to be taking, if we're going to, I don't think the fiscal conservative argument that mass incarceration, ending mass incarceration is going to save money, holds any water. That money needs to be redirected back into those communities to bring those communities back to economic life, back to social life, in order to be able to really end, reverse, whatever you want to call, needs to be done to mass incarceration. Without that kind of major reinvestment of resources, which require a change in mindset, we're not going to really address that. If we do decarcerate, we do take a lot of people out of prison, we're dumping them into massive skid rows, massive homeless camps and so forth, and we're not really addressing the fundamental problem that mass incarceration has been devoted to, which is a so-called solution to the issue of poverty.
Well, thank you so much, James, for joining us to talk about this important issue and about your book, Understanding Mass Incarceration, An Introduction to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time. And you'll be speaking more about your book next week, Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Independent Media Center, right?
That's right. As I'm looking forward to that conversation, I'm going to focus largely on the idea of alternatives to incarceration, talking about that changing in mindset and what are some of the alternatives that might be viable and some which might not be so viable.
Well, thank you so much, and I look forward to hearing more about your book.
Thanks very much, Rebecca. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Smile Politely Radio. SmilePolitely.com is the place to go for all things local, arts, culture, food and drink, news, opinion, tech, and more. And to take us out, we are going to hear Sun Stereo play Better Than Yesterday. They are performing at High Dive on Saturday at 8 o'clock. Have a great weekend.
Hit the snooze, go back to bed. I pulled the covers up over my head. No time for shower or shave. I'm rolling out the door. I lock away my dream for the day. Money spent to pay the rent, and all I can do is vent. It's alright, cause I feel better, better than yesterday. My shoes to ride the bus. I don't mind it all that much. He tips his hat, I wave. The driver of the bus for 5 years in the day. Sacrifice he had to save. He put his last kid to college in May. And he's always feeling better, better than yesterday. Better than yesterday.